Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. U.S. suspect in Minnesota lawmaker killing arrested after manhunt. Vance Luther Bolter is taken into custody in the woods after a two-day search by Sadie Gurman, John McCormick, and Alyssa Luckpat. A man suspected of shooting two state Democratic lawmakers was arrested late Sunday after authorities tracked him into a wooded area in rural Minnesota, law enforcement officials said. The capture of 57-year-old Vance Luther Bolter ends a two-day manhunt that left the community on edge. He is wanted by police in connection with the killings of State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband and the shootings of Senator John Huffman and his wife Yvette Huffman. The state Democratic politicians were shot early Saturday morning in what Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called an act of targeted political violence. Law enforcement officers searched properties on Sunday in Sibley County after a vehicle that may have been used by the suspect was found along a local highway, according to the sheriff's office. Residents were told to keep their doors locked and vehicles secure. Bolter lives in the county southwest of where the shootings unfolded. Authorities earlier said they found a list in the suspect's vehicle that named other public officials. It had dozens of names, including prominent individuals who support abortion rights in Minnesota, as well as many Democratic lawmakers, and also abortion providers, according to an official who has seen the document. Authorities spoke with several members of Bolter's family, including his wife, who was carrying passports and cash when police stopped her near a convenience store about 70 miles north of the shootings, a law enforcement official said. The shootings were politically motivated, and there were clearly some through line with abortion because of the groups that were on the list, said Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat of Minnesota, on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday. Klobuchar, the senior senator from Minnesota, is mentioned in the suspect's writings, according to a person with knowledge of a briefing on the subject. The senator said she was with Hortman and her husband at a big political dinner the night before the killings. That was the last time so many of us saw Melissa and Mark. She said Walz, a Democrat, called her at 5 a.m. Saturday to tell her about Hortman's death. Klobuchar said Huffman and his wife were hanging in there. She later shared a message from Yvette Huffman, who said she and her husband were incredibly lucky to be alive after being shot multiple times. John is enduring many surgeries right now and is closer every hour to being out of the woods, his wife said in the statement. On Sunday morning, Hortman's home in Brooklyn Park was surrounded by yellow police tape. Plywood covered the front door and several windows. A police cruiser and several media teams were parked across the street. Elka DeBade, a retiree who lives about one hole away on the golf course behind the Hortman home, walked about half a mile to see the house. It's shocking, she said, noting that she and her husband had lived in the area since 1993 and consider it very safe. The couple got an alert from the police to shelter in place on Saturday around 5:30 a.m. They weren't allowed to leave until 3:30 p.m., she said. Records show that Bolter lived with his family in a house in rural Green Isle, Minnesota, about an hour's drive from Hortman's home. He stayed a few nights a week in a rental home in Minneapolis with roommates. One of his roommates, David Carlson, said Bolter was working overnight shifts for an organization that handles eye donations while trying to get a private security company off the ground. Bolter has also served as a Christian preacher, including at a church in the Congo. On Saturday, Carlson said that he woke to a text from Bolter saying he was going to be gone for a while and maybe dead shortly. Carlson said he called the police. Bolter had voted for President Trump and was against abortion, Carlson said. Police responded to the shootings around 2 a.m. Saturday. Police were called first to Hoffman's home. Officers then went to check on Hortman's home around 3:35 a.m. and spotted the suspect emerging from her house, said Brooklyn Police Park Chief Mark Brulee. The suspect was dressed as a police officer, and there was an SUV in the driveway with emergency lights on, according to Brulee. The suspect, who wore a badge and police gear, retreated into the house and escaped on foot out the back, he said. Political figures from across the spectrum condemned the shootings, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, asked that lawmakers be given a briefing on security once they return from a recess. The level of threat that lawmakers are exposed to is just unacceptable, said Senator Tina Smith, Democrat, Minnesota. On to our next story. Economy. China's May data paints mixed picture as U.S. trade tensions linger. Retail sales rose 6.4% in May, while industrial production increased 5.8%. China's activity data for May was a mixed bag, with trade frictions with the U.S. weighing on growth, but a key gauge of consumption surpassing expectations. Retail sales rose 6.4% on year in May, the fastest pace since December 2023. According to data released Monday by the National Bureau of Statistics, buoyed by Beijing's consumer subsidy push, that topped April's 5.1% increase, exceeded by the 4.9% growth anticipated in a Wall Street Journal's poll of economists. The robust print was largely driven by China's version of the Cash for Clunkers program, under which consumers receive subsidies for smartphones, home appliances, cars, and a host of other products. However, many local governments have recently paused the subsidies after shopping sprees drained the program's accounts faster than expected, highlighting its limitations. Monday's figures also showed that industrial production rose 5.8% in May from a year earlier, slowing from April's 6.1% gain and missing the 5.9% increase forecast in the WSJ poll. Fixed asset investment grew 3.7% in the January to May period, down 4.0% in the first 4 months of the year. China's surveyed urban unemployment rate stood at 5.0% in May, edging down from 5.1% in April. The data offer a snapshot of China's economy following a mid-May truce with the U.S. The agreement rolled back most of the tariffs imposed by both sides, providing temporary relief to Chinese exporters that face duties of up to 145%. Still, tensions quickly resurfaced, with the world's two largest economies accusing each other of breaching the détente via export controls. Talks in London last week helped restore the fragile truce, but the deal remains subject to the approvals by U.S. President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Beijing's stepped-up fiscal and monetary support has helped stabilize the economy amid external pressures, though challenges persist, including a protracted housing downturn and weakened consumer confidence. Separate data on Monday showed that home prices in major cities fell at a faster pace in May, while both property sales and investment remained in decline over the January to May period. Analysts say the resilience of Chinese exports, helped by trade rerouting, may reduce the urgency for additional stimulus or a quick deal with Washington. With export resilience extending into June, China may not feel immediate pressure to reach a deal with the U.S. or to stimulate the economy, city economists wrote in a note to clients last week. Zhiwei Zhang at Pinpoint Asset Management cautioned Monday that while front-loading has boosted China's manufacturing sector so far this year, its sustainability is unclear. The economic outlook for the rest of the year is uncertain, Zhang said. Commodities and futures. Oil keeps gaining as markets watch Middle East escalation. Gold also gained, though the precious metal was off the highs hit Friday. By Amanda Lee. Oil prices marched higher as Israel and Iran continued air attacks against each other, sustaining a sense of uncertainty across markets in Asia. Sirens sounded across Israel early Monday, warning of another barrage of missiles from Iran. That came after Israel's military said it was striking dozens of targets in Iran on Sunday. The furious exchange of fire between Israel and Iran leaves little doubt about unprecedented escalation in the Iran-Israel conflict, said Vishnu Vararanthan at Mizuho Securities. That said, the hope for now is that the conflict won't erupt into an all-out war that threatens regional stability, he added. Front month WTI crude oil futures were last up 1.3% at $73.90 a barrel, while front month Brent climbed 1.1% to $75.04 a barrel. That followed a surge on Friday when news of Israel's attack first broke, sparking double-digit percentage gains. Spot gold was up 0.3% at $3,443.53 a troy ounce, though it was off the highs hit Friday. Stock markets rebounded somewhat from the weakness at the end of last week. Japan's Nikkei stock average was up 1.0%, while South Korea's Kospi advanced 0.6%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index was up 0.1%, while China's Shanghai Composite Index was up 0.2%, reversing opening losses after the release of Chinese economic data. Singapore Straits Times Index was 0.3% lower, and Malaysia's KLCI was down 0.2%. Futures tied to U.S. indices were steady. E-mini S&P 500 futures were up 1.1%, NASDAQ futures rose 1.3%, and Dow Jones futures added 0.9%. In currency markets, the U.S. dollar was mostly stronger against Asian currencies. The market's focus will remain on the Middle East developments. Mizuho's Vararanthan sees incentives for de-escalation on both sides of the Israel-Iran conflict that could curb tensions. Nonetheless, the situation is highly combustible as the scope for miscalculation between the various parties involved is exceptionally high, he said. Exclusive airlines. Southwest Airlines adds cockpit alerts to boost runway safety. Honeywell-designed alerts warn pilots against dangerous takeoffs or other risky situations at airports. By Andrew Tangle. Southwest Airlines is adding a new cockpit alert system to help its pilots avoid dangerous situations after carriers navigated a series of close calls at U.S. airports in recent years. The Honeywell design system delivers verbal warnings and text alarms if a pilot is about to use the wrong runway, for example, or take off from or land in a taxiway. The Dallas-based carrier said the system has been added to nearly all of Southwest's approximately 800 aircraft. It is a really powerful tool, we believe, to add more barriers to potentially bad outcomes. Andrew Watterson, Southwest Chief Operating Officer, said in an interview. The cockpit alerts are akin to warning systems in modern cars that detect other cars in blind spots or if a driver is about to back into another vehicle. Government and aviation industry officials have focused more on such alerts as accidents and harrowing close calls have drawn attention around U.S. airports in recent years. Southwest aims to avoid scenarios like one that occurred on March 20. A Southwest plane began taking off from a taxiway at Orlando International Airport instead of the intended runway running alongside it, the kind of mistake that could risk a collision with another aircraft or a crash if a taxiway is too short to enable takeoff. An air traffic controller intervened, helping avert potential disaster. The Honeywell alert might have alerted the pilot sooner, warning, on taxiway, on taxiway. Southwest decided to add the Honeywell alerts to all Boeing 737 fleet around early 2024 as part of the airline's effort to manage emerging safety risks, Watterson said. In December 2024, he said, Southwest began directing flight attendants to do pre-landing cabin cleanup earlier, around 18,000 feet instead of 10,000 feet, aiming to reduce flight crew injuries. In August 2024, a Federal Aviation Administration advisory panel recommended that the agency require newly produced aircraft to come with certain cockpit alerts, but it didn't make a recommendation on requiring retrofits for existing airline fleets. An FAA spokesman said the agency is reviewing the recommendation. Other carriers, including Alaska Airlines, have added the Honeywell alerts. Plane makers Airbus and Boeing have separately been working on their own runway safety alerts for their aircraft. Certain alerts may be installed but not activated, depending on airline's preference. The Honeywell alerts are designed to help pilots avoid a range of potential airport hazards. In addition to helping prevent pilots from using the wrong surface, the alerts can tell pilots if they are coming in too high or too fast for a landing. They happen more than we want to think that they happen, said Thea Feyerson, a senior aerospace engineer at Honeywell. In 2006, a Comair regional jet tried to take off in Lexington, Kentucky, on a runway that was too short, leading to a crash that took 49 lives. In 2017, an Air Canada jet nearly landed on a taxiway in San Francisco's airport, where four planes loaded with some 1,000 passengers were lined up. The National Transportation Safety Board found in 2018 that Honeywell's suite of alerts, known as the Runway Awareness and Advisory System, might have alerted the Air Canada pilots well before they nearly crashed into the other planes. Southwest pilots broadly appreciate the new alerts, pilot union leaders said, despite some initial concerns the warnings could become nuisances. They said the system has, in some cases, helped prompt pilots to redo landing approaches and maintain proper speeds on taxiways. It gets your attention, said Captain Jody Revan, a pilot for the carrier who is president of the Southwest Airlines Pilots Association. It's not so important in Midland, Texas, but when you're in Philly or LA, it's a great added tool. Investing, red versus blue is dividing stock portfolios like never before. A political gap in optimism about markets is translating into trading decisions. Baghujan Banjari. An adage on Wall Street holds that it is unwise to play politics with your portfolio. Americans are increasingly doing just that. A Gallup poll this spring showed that Democrats who expected stocks to tumble over the next 6 months exceeded Republicans by 59 percentage points. Republicans expecting stocks to climb over that period topped Democrats by 47 percentage points. That optimism gap is translating into trading decisions. David Satkin, partner at Bel Air Investment Advisors, who oversees around $12 billion in assets for wealthy individuals, said that has become clear in calls he has received from clients since President Trump's tariffs this spring roiled markets. One wealthy couple, who weren't fans of Trump's policies, asked Satkin about moving all assets abroad, fearful that American assets from U.S. stocks to bonds to the dollar would tank on the president's watch. If I know how people voted, I could tell how they feel about the stock market, Satkin said. The party affiliations of Americans have long shaped how they feel about the economy or the price of eggs and milk at the grocery store, as people give lower marks when their party is out of power. The perception gap started growing much wider after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, according to a monthly consumer survey conducted by the University of Michigan. The 47-point gap in partisan optimism regarding the stock market's trajectory is the largest divide observed in Gallup data provided to the Wall Street Journal going back to 2001. That year, during George W. Bush's presidency, the optimism gap between Republicans and Democrats stood at 13 percentage points. A group of researchers in a study analyzed security filings for local independent investment advisors in 309 U.S. counties and found that wealthy people who lean Democratic or Republican are choosing different stocks. The divide between their portfolios emerged in 2013 when Barack Obama was president and kept growing through 2019 when Trump's first term, according to Elena Piculini, one of the study's authors. One investor who voted for Trump and isn't too concerned about the tariff turmoil is Bruce Bestin, a 68-year-old restaurant owner in Louisville, Kentucky. He said media hype about how tariffs would pummel the economy created buying opportunities for him during the big market swoon in April when he picked up stocks, including NVIDIA. In general, when a person with his mindset is in office, it's good for the business environment, said Bestin, who holds shares of around two dozen companies and has typically favored financials and energy stocks. What's good for the business environment is good for the stock market. Wall Street is finding ways to capitalize on investors' partisanship. Trump Media and Technology Group, the media company tied to the president, launched investments giving individuals access to non-woke companies. Funds including the American Conservative Values ETF and Point Bridge America First ETF, which goes by the ticker MAGA, have drawn tens of millions of dollars in assets. The Conservative Values ETF has roughly tracked the S&P's 500's performance over the past 3 years. The MAGA fund has lagged behind the S&P 500 by more than 20 percentage points. At the same time, those who sold at the height of April's tariff turmoil would have missed out on recovering their losses when stocks staged a full recovery. The S&P 500 is now back near all-time highs, showing why buying and selling based on political leanings can be disastrous for portfolios. Investing $1,000 upon President Dwight Eisenhower's inauguration in 1953 and holding only when a Republican was president would produce about $29,000 today, according to Paul Hickey at Bespoke Investment Group. The same sum held only during subsequent Democratic administrations would be worth more than double that. Simply buying and holding would have yielded around $1.9 million. That offers only so much comfort to those who remain nervous about the fallout from Trump's rapid shifts in policy. Ekneth Belbase in Ithaca, New York, started moving more of his money internationally, worried about high valuations in the U.S. The president's spat with Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office led him to rethink America's relationship with the rest of the world. The 54-year-old said he has trimmed his U.S. exposure to around 50% of his stock holdings. Some investors said that doing nothing might still be the best move, whatever one's political leanings. Ronald Gallagher, an 81-year-old retiree in Paradise Valley, Arizona, voted for Trump and thinks stocks will likely do better under his administration than they would if Kamala Harris had won. But he stayed the course during the Biden administration, and the past 2 years were good to his portfolio, even if he doesn't think Biden deserves the credit for stocks' back-to-back gains of more than 20%, the best showing in a quarter century. They were okay, Gallagher said of the returns. It wasn't through Biden. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. Markets and finance. Australia's security regulator launches inquiry into ASX. The Australian Securities and Investments Commission decided on the inquiry due to concerns shared by the Reserve Bank of Australia, by Stuart Condy. Australia's securities regulator has launched an inquiry into share market operator ASX after what it called repeated and serious failures that raised doubts over its ability to maintain critical trading infrastructure. The Australian Securities and Investment Commission on Monday said it has decided on the inquiry due to concerns shared by the Reserve Bank of Australia. Investors and market participants deserve to have absolute confidence that ASX is operating soundly, securely, and effectively, ASIC Chair Joe Longo said. ASIC's decision to initiate an inquiry follows repeated and serious failures at ASX. The inquiry repeats another regulatory headache for ASX, which is considering job cuts amid a long-running overhaul of its aging clearing and settlement system that has cost hundreds of millions of dollars. ASX already faces legal action launched by the regulator over allegations it has made misleading statements related to the progress of its clearing and settlement overhaul. On Monday, ASIC said it would discontinue an inquiry into that failure and fold the issue into the broader inquiry. ASX Chairman David Clark said that the market operator would cooperate fully with the inquiry, which will be led by what ASIC said is an expert panel empowered to make recommendations. ASX is 2 years into a 5-year strategy of technology modernization. We welcome the opportunity for independent parties to review the work underway and advise on what more we can do, Clark said. Shares in ASX were down 4% in early trade at $69.83, equivalent to US $45.30. The stock's consensus rating is sell, according to Visible Alpha. Opinion: The Art of a Spectrum Deal. Cruz and Trump break a political impasse to free airwaves for auction, by the editorial board. Who would have expected that broadband spectrum would create an enormous logjam in Congress? Well, it has. But at long last, Republicans have struck a deal to auction more government spectrum as part of the tax bill, which may be the closest thing there is to a free government lunch. The 2023 expiration of the Federal Communications Commission's authority to sell government spectrum licenses has slowed plans to build out broadband networks and put existing airwaves to more productive use. However, discussions in Congress to renew the FCC authority stalled owing to lack of leadership by Joe Biden. Federal agencies have resisted relinquishing their spectrum even when they aren't putting it to good use. They also don't want private companies building in their spectrum backyards. The Defense Department claims private deployment in certain frequency bands will disrupt its systems, though the FCC disagrees. Credit to Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Mr. Trump for massaging the competing interests. Their mooted deal would give the FCC authority to auction 800 megahertz of spectrum through 2034, with 500 of that coming from government agencies within the 1.3 and 10.5 gigahertz range that is especially useful for mobile providers. The deal excludes from the auctions two bands, 3.1 to 3.45 gigahertz and 7.4 to 8.4 gigahertz, that defense claims could interfere with satellites and radar. Because defense holds the bulk of government spectrum, it would still have to make some of its holdings available for the FCC to auction. Mobile providers and other companies could then bid for it. GOP senators and the Armed Services Committee, who earlier objected to the spectrum sales owing to concerns about military interference, are backing the deal. As President Trump recently noted on social media, bolstering national security and connectivity aren't mutually exclusive and can be reinforcing, never bent against American ingenuity. Republican leaders expect the auctions to generate $85 billion in revenue for the government over 10 years, but they will yield broader economic benefits. More spectrum in private hands will undoubtedly make internet faster and could reduce the cost of data plans. It could also help mobile providers compete with cable companies and fix broadband. Broader deployment of self-driving cars will require loads more spectrum, since remote overseers must be able to seize control of a vehicle instantaneously to avoid collision. A little latency isn't a big problem when streaming a movie, but it could have life and death consequences on the road. More spectrum will also facilitate more innovation in artificial intelligence. You are listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio as we continue on with our article. It could support more drones that assist with law enforcement, inspect infrastructure, such as transmission lines and railroad tracks, and deliver groceries. The sky of spectrum uses has no limit. Oh, and the deal will preempt Democrats in the future from using spectrum proceeds to fund broadband subsidies. Well done. Opinion: Trump's good deportation exceptions. He asks ICE to spare the farm and hospitality industries from raids. By the editorial boards. Good news on the mass deportation front. President Trump has listened to alarms from farmers and others and offered a reprieve from immigration raids for the agriculture and hospitality industries. We wrote Saturday about the contradictory social media messages the president was sending last week on deportations. And now we know why. He has instructed the Department of Homeland Security to ease up on deportations on businesses that rely heavily on migrant labor and can't easily find American citizens to fill in. He has listened to Brooke Rollins, his agriculture secretary, who warned about economic damage in the Farm Belt. Many recent migrant workers have valid work visas granted by the Biden administration. Even illegal migrants have some form of resident documentation that looks persuasive. The workers are typically diligent and often do work that would otherwise not get done. Mr. Trump also knows firsthand from the Trump Organization's hotels and resorts the necessity of bringing in workers from abroad on work visas. Labor shortages are routine every summer in the U.S., which is why business groups lobby for more H-2B temporary visas, many of them filled by young people from Europe or Canada. Sending immigration and customs enforcement agents to raid farms, hotel cleaning staff, and restaurant busboys and cooks is damaging to the economy and a misuse of scarce federal manpower. Better to focus on criminals instead. The ICE exceptions are also smart politics given the nature of Mr. Trump's political coalition. It includes thousands of small business employers who were frustrated by federal government regulatory harassment. They don't want that replaced by ICE agents raiding their workplaces to snatch and deport law-abiding longtime employees. The coalition also includes Hispanic Americans who live in the communities now frightened by ICE raids. Mr. Trump told us in October that he needed to show heart among the firmness in immigration enforcement. More exceptions, please. Middle East. Israel takes control of Iran's skies, a feat that still eludes Russia and Ukraine. The power mismatch in the Israel-Iran war shows the importance of air superiority. By Yaroslav Trofimov. Within 48 hours of starting its war on Iran, Israel said it gained air superiority over the western part of the country, including Tehran. Israeli warplanes began dropping bombs from within Iranian skies instead of relying on expensive long-range missiles. That is a feat that the giant Russian Air Force has been unable to achieve in Ukraine in 3.5 years of war. The setback is one of the reasons why Moscow's troops have been bogged down in grinding trench warfare, sustaining staggering losses ever since they failed to rapidly seize Kyiv in February 2022. On Sunday, Israel was exploiting its advantage, saying it has taken out dozens of surface-to-air missiles in western Iran and killed the intelligence chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, along with his deputy. The two wars are very different in many respects. For one, there is no conventional land component to the Israeli campaign in Iran. But the experience of these two conflicts, closely observed by militaries around the world, reinforces what war planners have known for decades. Control over air is everything if you can get it. The two campaigns are showing the fundamental importance of air superiority in order to succeed in your overall military objectives, said retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, who oversaw Allied air operations against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in 2001. In the case of Russia-Ukraine war, you see what happens when neither side can achieve air superiority. Stalemate and devolution to attrition-based warfare, he said. In the case of the Israel-Iran war, it allows them unhindered freedom to attack where they possess air superiority over segments of Iran. The initial Israeli airstrikes were using the fifth-generation stealth F-35 aircraft enhanced with Israeli modifications. Now that most of Iranian air defenses have been suppressed, older warplanes such as F-15 and F-16 are joining the fight. Israel has also started dropping short-range JDAM and SPICE-guided bombs, which are cheaper and much more abundant than missiles, to devastating effect. Over the past 24 hours, we completed an aerial route to Tehran and conducted an aerial breaching battle. IAF pilots are flying at great risk to their lives, hundreds of kilometers away from Israel, striking hundreds of different targets with precision, said Israeli military Chief of General Staff Lieutenant General Ayel Zamir. The Israelis now have the ability to use the whole suite of their offensive weapons in greater mass, more efficiently, and spreading them out, said retired British Air Marshal Martin Sampson, who directed British air operations against Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and now heads the Middle East office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. From Israel's side, the campaign objective is to destroy and degrade, and Iran doesn't have that ability. The Israelis have certainly learned from Russian failures and Ukrainian successes as they plan their own campaign against Iran. But military officials and analysts say the most obvious lesson so far is that the Israeli Air Force is intrinsically more capable than the Russians, while Ukraine is much better at defense than Iran. Israel achieved surprise and overmatch over Iran air defense, which represented a much easier target set than Ukraine's air defenses in almost every respect, said Michael Kaufman, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment and an expert on Russian and Ukrainian militaries. The asymmetry in qualitative capability between Israel's air force and Russia is also vast and can be easily observed. Retired British Air Marshal Edward Stringer, who ran the air campaign in Libya in 2011 and headed operations for the British Ministry of Defense, said that the overall culture, sophisticated training, and innovation of the Israeli Air Force, combined with its integration into the intelligence and cyber capabilities, is a key reason why the Israelis succeeded where the Russians have failed. All the Russians have is pilots. They grow these pilots to drive flying artillery, and that's it, he said. Just like Ukraine, whose Soviet jet fighters were badly outdated by 2022, Iran doesn't have warplanes capable of surviving air-to-air combat with its foe. Unlike Ukraine, however, Tehran has spectacularly failed to organize ground-based air defenses in ways that could have significantly impeded the ability of enemy aircraft to operate over its territory. This was, above all, the result of a fatal political miscalculation. Over decades, Tehran underinvested in air defenses and bet instead on the deterrent firepower of its own missile forces and those of its regional proxies. Iran never relied on air defenses alone to ward off attacks like this. The idea was always to use deterrence, said Fabian Hintz, a military expert at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. But the main component of Iranian deterrence, Lebanon's Hezbollah militia, was decimated by Israel last year, and then physically severed from Iran by the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria. Subsequent Israeli bombing of Syrian air defense installations created a superhighway that Israeli aircraft can use unimpeded on their way to Iran. Ukrainian air defenses, primarily the Soviet vintage S-300 and Buk systems, were much more robust and better integrated in 2022 than Iran's turned out to be once Israel attacked. Tehran relies on the mishmash of S-300, Chinese batteries, and locally made air defense systems. Equally critical was the element of surprise. Thanks to U.S. intelligence warnings about the impending Russian invasion, the Ukrainian military command dispersed and concealed the bulk of its mobile air defenses in February 2022. After a handful of Russian jets were downed over Ukrainian cities, manned Russian aircraft stopped operating beyond the front line, a situation that remains in place today. To strike targets deep inside Ukraine, Russia must rely on the limited supply of cruise or ballistic missiles, or on drones, which are slow and carry a limited payload. Ukraine is using its own drones to strike back. Unlike Ukraine in 2022, Iran was caught by surprise, in part because of deceptive Israeli threats to launch the attack should U.S.-Iranian talks scheduled for June 15th fail to produce progress. Instead, the war began 2 days earlier. Israeli special operations teams got into Iran covertly and destroyed key Iranian air defense assets with short-range drones at the start of the campaign, using a method similar to how Ukrainian intelligence barely 2 weeks earlier blew up several Russian strategic bombers. At the same time, Israel was able to assassinate much of Iran's military leadership, another operation made possible by superior spy work. Basically, what Israel did with Iran is what Russia wanted to do with Ukraine. They thought they could pull off some cloak and dagger thing and infiltrate and decapitate the Ukrainian regime, said Michael Horowitz, an Israeli geopolitical analyst. But it turned out that the Ukrainian society has a resilience and cannot be so easily penetrated. Whereas when it comes to Iran, the regime is so unpopular that it's easy to find people there who will agree to work with Israel. Despite Israeli strikes, which resulted in numerous civilian casualties alongside military targets, Iran continues to lob ballistic missile salvos at Israeli cities, also causing death and destruction. Time, however, now appears to be on Israel's side, at least in the immediate future. It's a numbers game, and it seems like Israel has the upper hand because they can now go after the missiles that are shooting at them with direct attack. After all, the best way to shoot a missile is on the ground while it's in a container and not in the air while it's flying, said retired U.S. Air Force General Timothy Ray, a former U.S. Global Strike Commander. What the Israelis are doing is just steadily leveraging an advantage. Travel. Meet the Canadians breaking up with their beloved Maine vacation spot. Summer stays at Old Orchard Beach were a cherished annual tradition for many neighbors to the north until now. By Allison Pohl. George Poitras said he felt nostalgic for Old Orchard Beach the first time he visited as a teen. I'd like to show this to other people, he recalls, thinking of the Maine town and its smooth, sandy beaches. Later, he'd bring his three children for vacations to share Pier Fries and ride amusement park rides on warm summer nights. This year, though, the seaside town, where he and thousands of other Canadians come each summer, is caught up in a political maelstrom. The neighborly relationship between the two countries went south after President Trump threatened to make Canada the 51st U.S. state and hit it with tariffs. In response to the trade moves, then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called for Canadians to boycott U.S. travel and singled out Old Orchard Beach by name. And so, after heading here for most of the last 30 summers, Poitras is skipping his main stay for a trip to Quebec and Ontario instead. Canadian travelers, which account for about a quarter of all international tourists to the U.S., are boycotting it in droves this summer. But for those who are ending annual traditions to beloved spots like Old Orchard Beach, the decision feels more emotional than just rebooking a hotel. It is tinged with grief. Poitras said he is so resigned to his decision that he isn't even looking at hotel rates or campsite availability in the area. It's a political thing, it's not the people, Poitras said. The day I come back to Maine will be a happy day for me. Old Orchard Beach is a place of deep ties. Big hotel chains are absent. Local families operate inns that their parents or even grandparents owned. Many visitors book the same rooms and campsites every year, often with generations of family in tow. They walk the pier, give the children money for the arcade, and have late-night drinks on the waterfront, where the Canadian-American flags fly side by side. This year is going to be different. Up to 40% of the town's visitors come from Canada, according to the local Chamber of Commerce, and many are canceling plans. At the Royal Anchor Beach Resort, cancellations are double what they would typically be, and almost entirely due to Canadians, says owner Steve Cowan. Many have called directly to make clear that they don't have a problem with him or the staff whom they consider friends. Having families come back for generations, that's what we strive for, and that's what we live for, says Cowan, whose parents and grandfather also worked for Maine Resorts. We're hurting. Many of those families are Quebecois, who over the decades have been drawn to Old Orchard's beach, 7-mile stretch of sandy beach, and its warmer waters than further north. It isn't uncommon to hear her native French spoken around town, says Kimberly Marin of Montreal, who sometimes combines a stay with a hiking trip to Maine's Arcadia National Park. Now on Facebook pages, including for Old Orchard Beach, Marin sees comments telling Canadians to stay in their own country, and it stings. It also concerned her that a group of friends taking a motorcycle trip into New England were questioned by U.S. officials, she adds. We feel threatened by what is going on right now, says Marin, who has decided to boycott U.S. travel right now. Old Orchard is ready to welcome Canadians whenever they come, and they will be safe, says Kim Howard, executive director of the local Chamber of Commerce. Outside of the pandemic years, this is the first summer in about a decade that Kathy Curtis, 62, won't be taking an annual girls' trip to Old Orchard Beach. The four friends began the tradition once their children were grown, though the trips became shorter as the Canadian dollar weakened in recent years. As they drove into the town from Quebec and glimpsed the pier, a sense of relaxation would overwhelm them, she says. They would migrate to the pool after a day on the beach and share a few glasses of wine. This year, the four discussed the 51st Straight rhetoric over Facebook Messenger and decided their national pride outweighed spending vacation dollars in the U.S. They also worried about crossing the border in a car with Canadian plates. They still plan a trip in Canada, but haven't found a place that gives them the same feeling as Old Orchard Beach. We're hurting, not in a financial way, more or less, but in an emotional way, Curtis says. Though the retirees live less than 2 miles from the Vermont border, and Stan said, Quebec, she hasn't crossed into the U.S. since January. Trump's agenda to make America wealthy, safe, and beautiful again benefits Americans and international visitors alike, a White House spokeswoman said. President Trump cares about the great people of Canada and believes they would benefit tremendously from becoming America's cherished 51st state through stronger border security and no tariffs. Hit from both ends. Keith Welch, innkeeper at the Sundial Oceanfront Suites, said he's had a couple of cancellations, but some longtime Canadian visitors say they can't stay away. One group of women who come every summer called to assure they'd be returning regardless. They decided that since they knew me and had been coming here for so long, that was more important than striking out against the administration's policies, he says. Overall, in Old Orchard Beach, bookings are down between 10 and 20% this summer, the local chamber said. John Donovan, who runs the Friendship Oceanfront Suites, has dropped his 3-night minimum to draw more business, but says U.S. tourists are being more cautious on spending too. We're getting hit from both ends, he said. Donovan said the phone lighted up when Trudeau held a televised press conference in March. Canadians are hurt, Canadians are angry, he said, of Trump's tariff plans. We're going to choose not to go on vacations in Florida or Old Orchard Beach. Wow, Donovan recalls saying some longtime Canadian visitors have said they're taking just this year off. He fears more of them won't be back for 4 years. By then, Donovan worries they might never return at all. Then they will just do whatever they did for 4 years and continue that tradition instead of coming back here. Exclusive cybersecurity. Cyber attacks on Washington Post strikes journalists' email accounts. Reporters covering national security and economic policy were the employees affected. By Dustin Voles, Isabella Simonetti, and Robert McMillan. A cyber attack on the Washington Post compromised email accounts of several journalists and was potentially the work of a foreign government, company officials told some affected staffers. In recent days, according to people familiar with the situation, staffers were told the intrusions compromised journalists' Microsoft accounts and could have granted the intruder access to work emails they sent and received, some of the people said. The reporters targeted include those on the national security and economic policy teams, including some who write about China, the people said. In an internal memo on Sunday, Post executive editor Matt Murray said he wanted to notify staff about a possible targeted, unauthorized intrusion into our email system, adding that the Post believes a limited number of journalists' accounts were affected. He said the company discovered the issue on Thursday evening and has begun an investigation. Murray previously helped manage a similar incident during his tenure as editor-in-chief at the Wall Street Journal. Microsoft declined to comment. Staffers affected by the hack were notified in recent days and have been instructed not to discuss the matter. Alongside senior security officials and politicians, journalists are among the most fruitful targets for nation-state hackers seeking to gain intelligence on behalf of foreign governments, according to law enforcement officials and cybersecurity experts. Reporters often speak to sources who might have valuable or sensitive information. Powerful surveillance tools have been frequently used against journalists and human rights activists. In a breach of Wall Street Journal parent News Corp disclosed in 2022 and dating back to at least early 2020, hackers were able to search emails and documents of journalists, including drafts of articles. They appeared to be interested in a range of issues of importance to Beijing, such as Taiwan and China's Uyghur ethnic groups, the journal reported. News Corp's cybersecurity consultant said at the time that the hack was likely meant to gather intelligence to benefit China's interests. The hack of the Post might be narrower, as it was believed to only breach emails, people familiar with the matter said. Reporters at the newspaper said they seldom put sensitive information into emails and instead prefer to use Slack for internal coordination and encrypted messaging services, such as Signal, to speak with sources. Murray, in his staff note sent Sunday afternoon, said the news outlet has taken several additional steps to secure its digital systems, including a forced credential reset for all Post employees. We do not believe this unauthorized intrusion impacted any additional Post systems or has had any impact for our customers, Murray said. Opinion: We are the face of Medicaid. Our healthcare system can't bear the strain of deep cuts. Republican senators demands risk-pulling bill apart, addresses conflicts in the Republican Party regarding the depth of Medicaid cuts. In a regrettable era of the us versus them politics, I would like to share one American family's Medicaid story. Our son, diagnosed with autism at age 3, qualified for Medicaid that funded critical therapies at home and in school, and it continues to fund some of his adult daycare today. My parents, both hardworking Americans who developed chronic conditions that required skilled care in their final years, both qualified for Medicaid after spending down their assets. We are the face of Medicaid in America. Our healthcare system can't bear the strain of deep Medicaid cuts. So many providers no longer accept the program owing to inadequate rates. Many nursing homes operate on the thinnest of margins, and our hospitals struggle to stay open in the face of increased costs and regulations. I hope Congress will consider the consequences of its choices on everyday Americans and our fractured healthcare system. By Melinda Lamos Jackson, Wakefield, Rhode Island. Opinion: Putin tries to wear Trump down. He thinks the U.S. president will lose patience and give up. By Leon Aaron. Vladimir Putin continues to confront Ukraine with absurd demands during so-called peace talks. Mr. Putin doesn't want peace. He wants victory, and he's playing President Trump to achieve it. Mr. Putin will drag on the war until Mr. Trump gets so bored of mediation and frustrated with U.S. assistance to Ukraine that he gives up on both. Moscow's list of demands would force Ukraine to sacrifice 20% of its territory and eventually its sovereignty by accepting Moscow's direction of its domestic and foreign affairs. Mr. Putin knows Ukraine won't accept this, even under White House pressure. Why the stalling? One possibility is that Moscow is trying to drag out the war to advance on the battlefield and demoralize the Ukrainians. Yet neither objective looks realistic. On the ground, Russia advances slowly at the cost of tens of thousands killed and wounded, and Ukraine's public opinion is staunchly against surrender. More likely, Mr. Putin's delays are meant to push Mr. Trump to follow through with his threat to walk away from the peace effort and from U.S. aid to Ukraine. America's departure would be a boon to the Kremlin. Ukraine counts on the U.S. for weapons, especially long-range Patriot air defense systems that shoot down Russian ballistic missiles. Patriots are already in short supply, and the Pentagon is diverting anti-drone missiles from Ukraine to the Middle East and Pacific. Without them, Russia can subject a defenseless Ukraine to catastrophic drone and missile strikes. Mr. Putin's bet on a U.S. exit is plausible. Mr. Trump's recent rhetoric on the war signals hopelessness, ignorance, and moral myopia. It's like two young children fighting like crazy, Mr. Trump told German Chancellor Friedrich Merz in the Oval Office on June 5th. There's some bad blood between the two. In reality, Ukrainians held the most favorable view of Russia of all polled nations before the 2014 Crimea invasion, and are rightly infuriated at yet another invasion that has cost them tens of thousands of lives, destroyed civilian infrastructure, and led to the kidnapping of thousands of Ukrainian children. Yet Mr. Trump reduces the conflict to inexplicable bad blood on both sides. Mr. Trump's moral indifference means he has no motivation, much less urgency, to help Ukraine. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds of Arizona.